Economic development is a phrase we hear frequently in Arizona as the state works to diversify its corporate and small business offerings. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk about Governor Doug Ducey's move to create a new office that's intended to streamline economic development and the marketing of Arizona domestically and internationally. I'll find out what economist Jim Rounds thinks of the move. Also, the already lengthy presidential campaign has included notable battles on the Republican side, with the candidates trying to claim the mantle of conservatism. Journalist and NPR commentator E.J. Dionne has written a new book about American conservatism from 1964 until today. I'll talk with Dionne about Goldwater and Reagan, among others. Plus, a new graphic novel called Southwest Noir features a number of Arizona authors telling some very dark and not-so-dark tales of the desert. And National Geographic's Nizar Ibrahim has been credited with finding the first semi-aquatic dinosaur. We'll discuss the Spinosaurus. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, the already lengthy presidential campaign has included notable battles on the Republican side, with the candidates trying to claim the mantle of conservatism. Journalist and NPR commentator E.J. Dionne has written a new book called Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. I'll talk with him about that and the current GOP presidential field. Plus, a new graphic novel called Southwest Noir features a number of Arizona authors telling some very dark and not-so-dark tales of the desert. I'll talk with artist Vince LaRue about that project. We start today's program with a look at Governor Doug Ducey's move to create a new office that's intended to streamline economic development and the marketing of Arizona domestically and internationally. The new Governor's Economic Opportunity Office will bring about 50 staffers from several agencies together, and it'll be led by Arizona Commerce Authority head Sandra Watson. Jim Rounds is an economist and president of Rounds Consulting Group, and he joins me now. Jim, thanks for being here.
Good to see you.
So what does this mean to you? Does this mean less emphasis on the Commerce Authority or what?
This is something that I think a lot of us have been waiting for a while. And so, you know, we've talked about the different ways of doing economic development. We have the tax cuts from the past, and there could be some more tweaking. We have the bigger economic development policies like the deal closing fund. But I've always thought that we could do better on blending tourism and economic development. And we talked about that a number of times. I feel like they're really putting this together. It's already been happening informally, but they're putting that part together. And then the other component, and one of the few areas that I was critical in the past, is I thought that we could be a better research entity in the state. If we're the smartest people at the table, you might not have to give away the $10 million deal closing fund check. You can maybe sell Arizona on our benefits that we already have, or we can identify some areas where we're weak, and they're bringing the research people together. So they're bringing these groups together, and I really, really like this chance for us to make this work.
Some people might say, though, grouping things together means, is there going to be less emphasis on one or the other? By putting tourism into something else, will you then de-emphasize that? You're saying no.
Well, here's what I heard so far, and I think to some extent, you can be optimistic about the plan, but we have to wait for the details and see who's going to be in charge of what, and it all depends on the people. We have to somehow increase our capability. If we're doing average in an area and then we add another group of average individuals, we're still going to be doing average. So we got to figure out if consolidating a little bit gives us some efficiencies. And if we add some research capabilities, if we're increasing the quality, I think it'll work. But tourism is supposed to still be its own entity in its own building. At least that's the discussion so far. So it'll still do marketing, but some of what it can do can blend with what ACA is doing. And then we're going to get a big bang for the buck.
And you think this is an organized plan? Because that's one thing that people worry about as well. Is this just sort of saying, well, here's an idea, we're not sure, let's sort of put things together? You're saying the governor has thought about this, his team has, and for better or worse, this is an organized plan.
Yeah, and we've talked enough, and I haven't been shy about saying this idea is stupid or this is going to turn backwards or it's going to cost too much. A lot of thought went into the plan that I saw, how they're going to combine the research efforts of the right groups. They identified the right groups, how they're going to be combining the tourism and economic development. And I think we're going to get more bang for the buck. And this is one of these things where I had a hard time describing if it's complex or simple. It's simple because this is stuff where we should already be the best at. It's complex because there's all these moving parts. And if they can pull it off, get the right people in place, this could be a bigger impact on economic development in Arizona than most of the things that we've seen so far.
And in the past, you have also talked about the energy, the funds being spent on attracting companies from other places, maybe not as much nurturing done here. Any signs to indicate there's going to be more nurturing here?
That's one area where I hope, and you know, I've used this term walk and chew gum at the same time, but it's the easiest for some lawmakers to understand. You can work on more than one thing at a time. You can work on getting the research people together. You can work on the tourism promotion, but you can also work on the workforce training. You can be working on getting that next small business, addressing regulatory issues, getting them to become that next medium-sized business that doesn't then walk out on Arizona. Mm-hmm. We can grow some stuff from within, and it takes just as long to change our economy, whether we're buying that next company coming in or we're nurturing the companies. So if it's going to take several years, why not work on both?
The governor's big on branding. Where do you see the Arizona brand right now?
It's way improved over where it was 2 or 3 years ago, and I think we're moving in the right direction. But even on that, there's still a lot of people that are hesitant about Arizona because of decisions that have been made in the past. But that's why you do some of these things. I was involved in a discussion about Ducey calling out California. You know what? It's all right to call out your competitors on occasion because we don't have to demonstrate that we're better than California in every category. We just have to be better in some categories that matter going forward. So it's kind of how you interpret it. You can interpret it from one perspective, like the economist perspective, or like the John Talton perspective, which is the one that was being debated over the last month. So it's to some extent, it's subjective, but I think we're on the right track. This is the first time I've seen a bill that I've been a little bit excited about on the economic development front. Usually it's just been noise until this point.
So let me follow up with branding a little bit more, because some people will sort of throw up their hands and say, well, branding, here we go again. But how important is branding to those of us who haven't heard it over and over again, for people in another state where you're either trying to attract business or attract visitors?
We have a different product, so we can bring in the marketing discussion. Branding for Coca-Cola is superior, so people have a positive image and they see a couple of commercials. You know, if you took a marketing class, you'll know that it takes 3 or 4 images coming up on the screen, and then you'll say, hey, we got to get some soda pop next time we go to the grocery store. It's different with a state because we're branding for the visitors, and that's why I think we can't lose focus on just the pure tourism aspect. Mm-hmm. We talked before, I would double their budget if I could, just the marketing component. Yeah. But if we can blend that with the business development, and that's part of the brand. So just saying Arizona, it's a really cool place to locate. That's not going to get people to locate here, or whatever phrase they come up with, and they've already come up with a few. It's going to have to be putting some numbers behind it too. But that gets back to this research entity. That gets back to this tourism, commerce, Arizona-Mexico Commission component.
Yeah, I want to go to a couple of events, Jim, in the last 90 seconds or so. A lot of attention given to the Phoenix Open. A lot of attention, of course, always given to Barrett Jackson. Both in North Scottsdale, both appealing to a broad base of folks, but in a lot of cases, are we just attracting people who are going to come for a couple or 3 weeks, or maybe spend, 3 months here, maybe spend December, January, February, whatever it may be? And not that that isn't valuable, but does that do anything for the real long-term legacy of this place?
The people that come here on the tourism side spend a lot of money. It's one of our biggest industries and generates a lot of revenue for the state as well. What if that person has a fantastic time and they decide to come an extra week? That's a net new activity that you can quantify and do the math on and show that it's going to have a positive effect on the state. But what if you're out at the Super Bowl, or what if you're at the Open and you see the governor out there and you see some of these executives out there and they're talking with the businesses? And I know for a fact that these soft things matter. They may end up coming back for another meeting to talk about locating their business. And again, you don't have to take jobs, every job from every state. If you just get a small percentage from a lot of these states where we have opportunities, we're going to do quite well.
Economist Jim Rounds, he's the president of Rounds Consulting Group in Tempe. Always good to see you, Jim. Thanks.
Thanks.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. The first in the nation primary is over, and the winner on the Democratic side was Bernie Sanders. The GOP victor was Donald Trump. As of the past few days, neither outcome was a surprise. But what do those results mean going forward? Is Trump in it for the long haul? Does Sanders have a chance to knock out the enormous favorite, Hillary Clinton? Or is New Hampshire something of an outlier? With me for a few minutes to talk about that is Wes Gullet, CEO of OH Strategic Communications in Phoenix. He was deputy campaign manager for John McCain's 2000 presidential run. Wes, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm good. Thanks for being with us. In particular, I wanted to ask you about New Hampshire first, because Senator McCain did really well in New Hampshire when he was running for president those couple of times. What do New Hampshire voters look for in their presidential candidates? Can we look at it as an outlier?
Well, you know, it can be an outlier. John McCain won New Hampshire twice. Once he got the nomination, once he didn't. And so what New Hampshire voters are looking for, and independents can vote in the primary, so they tend to, New Hampshire, live free or die is their logo. So they tend to be a little more independent-minded. They're they have a real streak of independence. I think that's why Bernie Sanders did really well there. I think Trump was a natural for New Hampshire, but I don't know that Trump won't be a natural in South Carolina as well, because of the star power. So you know, now it goes to South Carolina. All the national pundits are saying that it's you know, there's a big evangelical vote. Cruz may do better there because of that. It's going to be a fight between Trump and Cruz. We'll see what happens. I wouldn't rule out Jeb Bush at this point.
Who is the closest of this current GOP bunch to what Senator McCain was, maybe especially in 2000 when he was still sort of considered that maverick, and then 2008 when he won the nomination? Is there someone that stands out to you as most similar to him, and is that person doing well or struggling at this point?
Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I'm sure. Other than the hair color, I'd say that's probably not true.
Yeah. They both have white hair. Yeah. They're both mavericks, and they both did really, really well in New Hampshire. On the Republican side, you don't see that because John McCain, you know, I'm never going to compare John McCain to Donald Trump. You know, I think they're polar opposites. But I think that after New Hampshire, it was interesting. After New Hampshire in 2000, we raised $4 million in 48 hours on the internet. It was the first time that's ever happened. Yeah. Today, they're talking about Bernie Sanders raising $2.6 million on the internet. After New Hampshire, he'll probably raise $4 or $5 million in the 48 hours following New Hampshire, similar to John McCain. That money matters, and Bernie Sanders' ability to raise money is going to project him into an opportunity elsewhere as well. You just can't help it because you're going to have funding and you're going to be able to pay for staff and TV ads and those kinds of things. On the Republican side, you know, we'll see. Kasich, you know, he did fine. He got second. Trump still beat him 2-1. So it's, you know, I think that Trump's got the momentum. And the other thing that we don't appreciate about Donald Trump is that he's able to spend his own money. He's not spending the time or resources to raise money. And that's a big deal. that gives you an extra 40% of your time that these other people don't have. It gives you, asking for money is hard work, and it's debilitating to the candidate, too, because no one likes to do it.
So are we at a point, I know this is going to sound so ridiculous right now, but so Donald Trump, how strong a candidate is he as far as going forward? Is he someone where if he lost a couple of states in a row, he might say, all right, I've had enough of this, now it's hurting my brand?
I think that I believed early on that if he lost Iowa, that he'd take the wind out of his sails and he'd be, you know, demoralized and not like it, and it wasn't fun, and these people are mean to me, you know, and don't be so mean. But he did the opposite. It invigorated him. I think partly because he really, in his mind, thought that Cruz cheated him, and it was a typical insider political dirty trick. And it got him all fired up, so he redoubled his effort. The problem when you're running against a billionaire, you don't want to make him mad. Because once they release the hounds, then you're in trouble.
Wow. Well, all right. Now, I know you're a Republican, so I want to be delicate in how I ask this, because I know you have a particular perspective on this. How strong a candidate is Hillary Clinton once we get into some of the industrial states, once we get to Nevada? Do Republicans need to nominate someone other than Donald Trump or Ted Cruz to presumably defeat who ultimately people expect Hillary Clinton still to get the nomination? Do they need someone who is more of one of those so-called mainstream Republicans?
So I was looking back at historically, Bill Clinton lost New Hampshire to a neighboring senator in 1992.
Paul Tsongas.
He lost to Paul Tsongas. Paul Tsongas was sort of like Bernie Sanders, a very liberal northeastern senator. What did Bill Clinton do? He clobbered him in the South, just demolished him. Now, Bill Clinton was a Southerner. His wife is not necessarily a Southerner. It's a little different. And remember, he was the new Democrat. And Hillary is the new Democrat from 1992. So she's the old Democrat.
Okay.
Bernie Sanders is kind of the new guy. I think it's going to be a race. I think that Bernie Sanders has got something going with the young voters. And I think the Democrats get really energized with young voters.
So who is more likely to be president of the United States, Bernie Sanders or Ted Cruz?
Bernie Sanders.
Okay.
And if you look at the polling, this is something that people are missing. When you look at the head-to-head polling, Bernie Sanders is actually beating the Republicans better than Hillary is, because people don't like her. She has built-in negatives. She's been around a long time. Bernie Sanders is sort of the new toy to play with. And so even in the head-to-heads, Bernie Sanders is doing very well. And that'll change. I mean, you know, these far-left or far-right candidates, once they get knocked around a little bit in a general election environment, you know, the gloss comes off. But Bernie Sanders, I think Bernie Sanders would beat Ted Cruz like a drum.
Wes Gullet, CEO of OH Strategic Communications in Phoenix. Wes, we will find out whether you're right or not. Thanks for the time.
You're welcome, Steve. It's always good to be with you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll hear from E.J. Dionne, NPR commentator, about what he thinks about conservatism. And later this hour, the mysterious Spinosaurus. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership. Featuring the 2016 Crosstrek, a 34-mpg compact utility vehicle for that go-anywhere spirit. Shop Subaru.com.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Be with us today at 1 for BBC News Hour. Taking a look at some temperatures around the state right now, 53 degrees in Flagstaff, it's 57 in Prescott, 73 in Tucson, 70 degrees in Casa Grande, and down in Yuma, 76 degrees under sunny skies. Become a KJZZ business member and get connected with an audience that values public radio for balanced, factual information. Help keep this community resource strong with a philanthropic donation to the KJZZ business member program. You can learn more at businessmember.kjzz.org or call 480-774-8274. Right now in Phoenix, with 16% relative humidity, it's mostly sunny and 75 degrees at 1124.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The already lengthy presidential campaign has included notable battles on the Republican side, with the candidates trying to claim the mantle of conservatism. One prominent conservative publication, the National Review, devoted an entire issue to essays that denounced Donald Trump for not being a true conservative. What is a true conservative, and how much does it really matter to voters who aren't purists about the issue? In his new book, Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond, journalist and NPR commentator E.J. Dionne explores the topic, and he joins me now. E.J., from the 1964 campaign, when former Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater was the nominee, to now, has the definition of conservative changed in a practical way, and if so, how?
Well, I think Goldwater himself and the movement that came together behind him and that pushed him in a way into that campaign was in the process of changing the definition of conservatism back then. My book argues that ever since Goldwater's campaign, conservative politicians have had to make a series of promises about a smaller government, about pushing back cultural change, and more recently about the changing ethnic makeup of the country. Those two changings are intentional. and they haven't been able to keep them. What I argue is that when Goldwater came along, there were really two available conservatisms. One was the one he was pushing, which was a very anti-government conservatism. There is a famous quote from Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative, in which he declares that I have no intention of reforming government. I have little interest in streamlining government or making it more efficient, for I mean to reduce its size. Before Goldwater came along, and I think the alternative was Ike, Ike was very frugal. He believed in balanced budgets. He ran budgets very close to balance. He was pro-business, but he didn't make reducing government itself the centerpiece of conservatism. He, after all, gave us the student loan program that helped me and millions of other people to go to college. And he also had the biggest public investment program in the country's history with the Interstate Highway Program. So I think it was Goldwater, in the Goldwater period, it changed fundamentally. Now, Goldwater himself later in life became uneasy with the very movement that he had created. He was particularly uneasy with the religious right. Goldwater was much more a classic Western libertarian conservative. And so that came later. But what he set in motion was the movement we have today, only it's become more and more conservative with time.
Is there any practicality associated with that Goldwater conservatism now? Because it does seem at cross purposes to have people run for higher office with the purposes of reducing government. And then it seems like once they get there, they either realize, well, you can't quite do those things overnight, and you have to work with the other side.
You know, when you think about a kind of radicalization we're seeing, for example, in Donald Trump's candidacy or in Ted Cruz's candidacy, I think it comes from that frustration among conservatives. The first sentence of my book is the history of contemporary American conservatism is a story of disappointment and betrayal. And one of the big betrayals in the view of the rank and file is that they've been promised election after election a smaller government. But guess what? Every conservative president we've had since Goldwater, whether it's Nixon or Reagan or either President Bush, has either left government as big as it was when he took office or even bigger. Now, why is that? Well, essentially, it's because Americans may, in large numbers in the abstract, be anti-government. But it turns out they want quite a lot from government. The classic example, I think, examples are Medicare and Social Security. Many Tea Party members who say they want government cut down will also quickly say, but we're not talking about Medicare or Social Security because those are earned benefits. It is no accident that a lot of Tea Partiers are at or over the age of 65. And so when you start taking government piece by piece, people don't want to reduce it. So, yes, I think it leads to enormous frustration.
And you write a lot about conservative leaders who've been taken down. John Boehner is one. I thought of Newt Gingrich as another. Why is it that former President Reagan is still held up as the shining example, considering he was someone who did compromise with Democrats on a number of occasions? And as you mentioned, you know, I mean, government got bigger with him as well in certain ways.
My chapter on Reagan is called The Ambiguous Hero, and it begins with a quote from the conservative columnist Charles Krauthammer, who said, "You can choose your Reagan." And by that, Charles meant, and this is the theme of the chapter, that there really were at least two Reagans. One was the movement Reagan, who, by the way, became a national figure because of a speech he gave for Barry Goldwater a week before the 1964 election. The Reagan, the movement builder, really was an ideologue and did talk about dismantling programs. He did oppose Medicare when it was first suggested. He didn't like Social Security. But when he became president, and for that matter, when he was governor of California, he had to govern with Democrats, and he did it quite successfully and was willing to back off ideology when that was necessary. He cut taxes, but then he was willing to raise them when the deficit was skyrocketing. It continued to go up in his term, but he held it back with a tax increase. He made deals with Tip O'Neill on a variety of things. And for many conservatives at the time, it was almost a form of betrayal when he declared that, you know, Mikhail Gorbachev was a different kind of communist. It turned out Reagan was right about that. And so it depends on which Reagan you want to talk about.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. That's E.J. Dionne, NPR commentator and journalist. We're talking about his new book, Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. E.J., this is, goes through my head. It's a different Arizona senator, but Senator John McCain gets criticism and even was censured again recently by the Maricopa County Republican Party, primarily for not being conservative enough, but he continues to win re-election. Ultimately, do conservatives really want people like John McCain out, or does that take away the ability of getting anything done? You have someone who at least occasionally works across the aisle.
I write quite a lot about Senator McCain in my book, and in particular, his two presidential campaigns. And I think one of the tragedies of McCain's Awake campaign is that on the one hand, he actually did defeat more conservative candidates in the primaries, but when it came time to choose a vice president, he couldn't move toward the middle. You know, his preferred choices were either Joe Lieberman, the Democratic senator, who was then an independent, or Tom Ridge, the governor of Pennsylvania. And he was going to run into a big convention fight, and that's how he ended up picking Sarah Palin, which I think made his candidacy a lot more difficult. But purging has been the rule in Republican politics since Goldwater. We forget that there used to be a lot of liberal Republicans. Imagine that, people like Jacob Javits in New York or Ed Brooke in Massachusetts. It was a very long list. So they got purged in primaries, or in some cases got defeated in elections. And then it was time for moderates to be purged. So I think there is this desire for ideological purity in the party. The problem is, if you get too pure, you're not going to win elections anymore. A lot of the moderates in the Republican Party eventually lost to Democrats because as the party moved right, Democrats willing to vote for moderate Republicans, in some cases eager to have moderate Republicans in Congress, realized they were just empowering a majority that was, in the case of President Obama, going to obstruct what he was doing.
Which of the current presidential candidates most fits the definition of conservative that we've been talking about, and can that person actually win the White House?
I'm not sure that person can win the nomination. I think the guy who's closest, I think, to my definition in the book is probably John Kasich in this campaign. I think that once in a while Jeb Bush approaches it, but then at other times he doesn't, and I'm not sure carrying all the baggage that comes with the Bush name, it will come easily. A victory in either the primary or the election would come easily to him. I think the person who may best embody the spirit of the party now is Ted Cruz, and he has set about to unite all of the constituencies on the right end of the party, including especially the evangelical conservatives, the libertarian conservatives, the Tea Party conservatives. And then Donald Trump, I think the Trump phenomenon is something that everybody will have to pay attention to, not because they should take Trump himself seriously, but the anger and discontent, particularly of working class voters, people who've seen their living standards drop in the new economy. Republicans have gotten a lot of white working class votes for years and have taken them for granted and done nothing for this constituency. Democrats have a historic obligation going back to FDR to speak for these folks and to give them some remedy from the situation they face. So if something good comes out of Trump's campaign, I hope it's that people start paying attention to that hurt that's out there in the country. I think Trump is exploiting that hurt rather than responding to it.
Considering what people who call themselves conservatives have had to say about the nominations of Mitt Romney and John McCain, and going back to Bob Dole, as you mentioned, is there a situation where nominating Ted Cruz and having him lose in the general election, would that make conservatives potentially more defiant or more willing to compromise, saying, well, at least we got our guy in there and he couldn't win either?
You know, I completely agree with the premise of that question, that if you're a progressive like me, you would not be a Cruz supporter by any means. But I think giving that set of ideas a clear test and having it go down to defeat It would not be possible to claim, as conservatives did with McCain and even Mitt Romney, that, well, our ideas didn't have a shot. And I think if the Republicans did lose a third consecutive presidential election, as happened with the Tories in Britain, I think it would give some room for those who either instinctively know there's something wrong or at least are prepared to entertain that idea and reform the party. I think it would give them more room to act, maybe more courage to act, and to say, you know, we can talk about a certain set of ideas all we want, but we're going to continue to face defeat if this is what we stand for.
That's journalist E.J. Dionne. You hear him most Fridays on All Things Considered. We've been talking about his new book, Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. E.J., a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Well, great joy to be with you. Thank you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Arizona's issues with funding for K-12 education are well documented. Per-pupil funding and teacher pay are often cited as being among the nation's lowest. A new report put together by David Garcia, ASU professor and former state school superintendent nominee, indicates the shortcomings are even more definitive when it comes to Latino students. And David Garcia joins me for a few minutes to talk about his work. David, good morning.
Hi, Steve. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So what have you seen as far as state funding for districts and schools that have higher than average Latino enrollment? Is it even more definitive, as I mentioned, the shortcomings on the part of the state?
Yeah, without question. This is part of a report called State of Latino Arizona that I co-authored with Annabelle Aportella from the Center for Student Achievement and our partners ASU and APS and ACF giving us a hand, as well as the Phoenix IDA. And what we did is we split the state into quartiles, into groups of four, looking at the percent of Latino in each school, school districts, and charter schools. And just to set the context, our high Latino school districts, those with 75% Latino or more, are just simply in more need. They have 85% of their students on average qualifying for free and reduced lunch. Mm-hmm. Compared to just 43% for our low Latino school districts in terms of population, that's under 25%. They also have 16% of their students in English language learner status compared to only 2% for low Latino students. So we're looking at a situation here where for our high Latino students, there's just simply more need.
How about proposed bonds and overrides in districts with more Latino students? Have those come up? Have they been successful?
Well, interesting. What we started with, Steve, was state and local funding. And we took a look at state and local funds. And what's interesting is that just in state and local funds alone, our high Latino, most need school districts actually get the least amount of dollars on average. They get about $7,565. Compared to our low Latino school districts, again, those with less need get $7,954. Now, it is only after adding federal funds that the funds become equitable. After adding federal funds, our high Latino school districts get more dollars than our low Latino school districts. And the major takeaway there is that federal funds are absolutely critical to promoting and providing equity and equitable funding for our highest needs Latino school districts. And what I mean by equitable is that it is only after adding federal funds that school districts with the most need get the additional resources they need to address those needs. As you mentioned, we also took a look at bonds and overrides. Mm-hmm. And surprising, what's not a big surprise, is that our high Latino school districts have less property value than our low Latino school districts. What did surprise me is how low. Our high Latino school districts, their property value is only 37% of the property value of our low Latino school districts. And in a state where more and more pressure is being put on local funding sources, it just simply is putting more pressure on these high needs communities to make up the difference for the decline in state funding.
David, let's go to school choice, because school choice is something that's often talked about in Arizona, focused on choice here in the state. Are Latino students in charter schools? How does that compare to their non-Latino peers as far as how often? And are Latinos in charter schools achieving at a higher rate than those who are not in charter schools? How does that jibe together?
Steve, we didn't look at that issue. What we paid attention to was enrollment, really opportunity. And taking a look at that issue, we took a look at the nationally recognized schools in Arizona, those that have been recognized by U.S. News and World Report. And interestingly, the percentage of Latino students in traditional public schools that have been recognized by U.S. News and World Report was 28%, and with 57% of those student populations being white. In charter schools that have been recognized nationally, that figure drops to 18% for Latino students and increases, the white percentage of white students increases to 67%. And I think the point here is really opportunity and the opportunity for our Latino students to get a chance to be in some of our highest achieving schools.
David, we have about 2 minutes left, and I want to go to the much bigger picture, which is how much could modifying the state's K-12 funding formula help? Can there be specific things built in when it comes to helping lower income districts, as you mentioned, districts that have a higher Latino population? Is there something specifically that if people got behind it, the state could fix?
Steve, I think that what we're hoping to do with this report is start a community conversation about equitable funding. And you got to remember, you talked about fixing this. The state funding system is really, the foundation of it is local property taxes. And we have a situation with our Latino school districts, our high Latino school districts, where simply they are working with 30% of the property wealth of other school districts. And that puts them at a real disadvantage. And I think if we're going to get serious about that, we need to take a look at those inequities. And we're going to continue this. I am partnering with the Arizona Latino School Boards Association for a community discussion on March 23rd. And we're going to work with those school districts to have them understand the challenges they face and look for some options and look for some solutions to really rethink school finance.
That's ASU Professor David Garcia. He's also the former state school superintendent nominee. David, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about Southwest Noir and get ready for this one, the Spinosaurus. Stay with us.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Theater Company presenting Fences, the story of the race and class on a family's front porch in 1950s America. February 11th through the 28th at the Herberger Theater Center. Info at arizonatheater.org.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and kjzz.org. Well, Valley Forecast calling for more sunshine and above average temperatures for today. The average for today is 71. We may see 86 for the high and about the same for the next couple of days. No mention of rain in the Valley Forecast. Sunshine with highs in the mid to upper 80 degree range. In Valley traffic right now, eastbound on the Red Mountain Loop 202. Watch out for a collision blocking the shoulder at 24th Street. Here Now from Boston is coming up at noon. The presidential candidates head to South Carolina, where the electorate differs from Iowa and New Hampshire. We'll get a preview coming up at 12 o'clock. Right now, under mostly sunny skies, 75 degrees in Phoenix at 11:43.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. There's a lot more to Arizona than the desert, but that particular setting lends itself so well to mysteries and the unknown that it's hard for creative types to resist. The new book, Southwest Noir, includes short fiction based primarily in Arizona and featuring writers like James Salas, author of Drive, Barry Graham, and Jenna Duncan. A creative force behind Southwest Noir is French illustrator Vince LaRue, whose art is included in the book. He's in Phoenix for a visit and a book launch event this week, and he joins me now. Vince, you live in France. You don't live in Arizona. How did this project come together?
Well, it all started in 2010 when I did illustrations for Barry Graham, a Scottish writer who used to live in Phoenix. He's a noir writer and also a reporter, but some of his books were translated into French, and the publisher in charge put us in contact. And Barry suggested a graphic novel collaboration, and I instantly accepted the project.
And when was your first experience with Phoenix, and what was that like? Was that out in the desert? Was it in the city?
Well, I arrived the first time in April 2012 to meet Barry in person, and it was the first Friday. And a couple hours after the landing, I was immersed into First Friday, and we went to galleries, and it was like a different world for me, coming from a rural area in France, and especially with a scientific background. A different world opened, and connections immediately started.
But specifically, what is it about the desert that has been intriguing to you?
Well, I think I've always been fascinated by the imagery around the desert at a very young age, I guess, through comics or movies or cartoons. And coming here first time was just great, and I like the dry heat too.
When I think of noir, I think of movies of Alfred Hitchcock, maybe some detective films and detective sort of novels, that dark, that mysterious nature of things. How do you think of it?
It's also very a social genre. It talks about people, and there's Denis Leanne, I think, the author of Mystic River, defined noir as, he said something like, in Greek mythology, they fall from height. But in noir, they fall from the curb. So it's about stories that happen, and the darkness of the stories as well.
Some of the stories in Southwest Noir have a lot of text, maybe 20 pages for a story, and some are more in the graphic novel setting. How much do your illustrations match what's going on with the story? How important is that?
My graphic style is... was inspired by different artists like Frank Miller, who did the Sin City. It's noir. There's a lot of inking in the process, and my collaboration with Barry Graham, the first one, was in the noir genre as well. And afterward, I wanted to start a new project. But with different people, bringing as many people as we could, and work on different stories and not just one long graphic novel.
Now, writers, when they write, clearly have a vision in their head of what they think something should look like. This happens when a book is turned into a movie, for example. How does that work when it comes to the collaboration? Does your illustration have to really jibe perfectly with what the writer is thinking about? How does that work?
Oh, sure. But when it's collaboration, the result is a product of two visions. And so it's the fruit of a collaboration. It's not all the writer's vision, or not just the artist, the vision of the artist. For example, Barry says Dark Heat, our first graphic novel, is we are co-author, even if he wrote the story. But at the end... since there are pictures, there are two visions.
And our listeners know Robert Palo well because he's been a critic for us for a couple of decades now. Now, his story definitely did not fit in the noir category, to me at least. And people who know Robert's sense of humor, it's an interesting story. It's about, based on two Jehovah's Witnesses coming to his door, and he things involving his mother and whatnot.
But one of the points in the book is the connection to the Southwest or to the genre noir is not necessarily a noir story happening in the Southwest of the United States. It might just be the author, the writer, lives in this area. Someone sent me a story from the UK, Andrea Gibbons, but she used to live in Tucson. And so all of the people collaborating in the book are linked to the Southwest in a way or another, and most of them write noir stories.
We've been talking with Vince LaRue. He's the creative force behind Southwest Noir. There'll be a special book launch and book signing coming up on Friday at Fair Trade Coffee on Roosevelt in Phoenix. Vince, thank you for coming in all the way from France.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. In the course of a week, each of us experiences some kind of triumph, and it's usually relatively small. So what does it feel like to make a great discovery, a world-changing discovery? Nizar Ibrahim, National Geographic Emerging Explorer and Paleontologist, made one of those discoveries when he helped find the Spinosaurus, the largest predatory dinosaur even larger than a T-Rex. He'll be talking about that discovery and other aspects of his work tonight at 7:30 at the Mesa Arts Center as part of the National Geographic Speaker Series. And he's with me now. Nizar, welcome.
Hi. Happy to be here.
So the Spinosaurus. How did you know about the Spinosaurus, and how did you go about finding him?
Well, my interest in Spinosaurus really began with a book. When I was very young, I was this really strange, mysterious dinosaur only known from a few bones. And these few bones had been destroyed in World War II. So it became an almost mythological dinosaur. And for many decades, people were just finding teeth and little bits and pieces. But that was pretty much it. So I was really interested in uncovering new remains of this dinosaur.
So those parts were, in fact, destroyed in World War II, and you had to go back. I mean, how much had been discovered at that point? Just a very small percentage?
Well, several spines. So Spinosaurus has big, tall spines on its back, forming a giant, magnificent sail. So a German paleontologist had uncovered some of these spines and a strange lower jaw, a little bit like the lower jaw of a crocodile. So he didn't have much, but he knew it was a dinosaur like no other, and the bones were huge. So even at the time, he suspected that this creature may have been larger than T-Rex, which had only recently been described from North America.
And remind us how big T-Rex is and then how big Spinosaurus is. You're talking about multiple spines. That doesn't sound like a small creature.
Yeah, I mean, some of these spines are about as tall as a person. And Spinosaurus is about 50 feet in length, fully grown. Mm. So that's quite a bit longer than even the longest T-Rex. So it's a dinosaur that is interesting, not just because of its size, but also because of its strange anatomy. So I know people are really excited about, you know, the size of Spinosaurus, bigger than T-Rex. But for me, the most interesting thing about Spinosaurus is its lifestyle. Hmm. It's not only bigger than T-Rex, it has a very different kind of lifestyle. It was a river monster, the world's first semi-aquatic dinosaur.
Wow. So tell us more about that. Is that, I mean, it could get you on land or in the water if it wanted
to? Yeah, so we know that Spinosaurus lived in a really strange kind of environment. So 100 million years ago, the Sahara Desert was a river system. And I call it the River of Giants because we found remains of giant fish. We're talking things like car-sized coelacanths, 25-foot-long sawfish. I mean, really big fish. And Spinosaurus is the first dinosaur to really fully take advantage of such an ecosystem. And this dinosaur evolved adaptations for a life largely spent in water hunting giant fish. So that's why I'm calling it a river monster.
Okay, Nizar, I'm glad the lights are on in the studio because I was starting to get a little bit scared there. This is freaky stuff. This is amazing. So how did you, when you talk about putting Spinosaurus together, what's the process behind that? And give us an idea. We talk about multiple spines, a creature this large. How were you able to actually get it all done?
Well, it was really difficult because, again, if we compare this dinosaur to better-known dinosaurs like T-Rex or Diplodocus, you know, we have lots and lots of skeletons for these animals. With Spinosaurus, we have a new partial skeleton, but it's not complete. And then, of course, we just have drawings and a few photographs of the bones that were destroyed in World War II. So we have to combine all of this information, piece our dinosaur together. But the difficult thing about this was that we didn't really have a blueprint for Spinosaurus. You know, typically big predatory dinosaurs have a large skull like T-Rex, pretty wide, short forelimbs, long hind limbs. Spinosaurus, completely different. Spinosaurus has long, slender jaws like a crocodile, a giant sail, powerful forelimbs, hind limbs that are much shorter, and they may even have been webbed. So working on Spinosaurus was really more like working on an extraterrestrial from outer space.
Now, I have to ask this question. Now, we think about how exciting this is to have found Spinosaurus. In the big picture of learning more about what was going on in that area all those years ago, and also maybe advancing, what does a discovery like this mean maybe for science going forward, or having us learn something from it?
Well, you know, in paleontology, of course, we do more than just naming new dinosaurs and, you know, trying to understand their biology. What we're really doing is we're piecing together this grand epic story, the history of life on our planet. And it is, without a shadow of a doubt, the greatest story out there. So piecing together this story allows us to travel back in time, and that is very important. At the time when Spinosaurus was alive, our planet was going through a period of extreme climate change, very high sea levels. And if we really want to understand how global changes, like climate change or extinction events, affect life and ecosystems on our planet in the long term, the only way to really understand this is to travel back in time and understand these lost worlds. So, you know, our work really has a lot of importance, even, you know, for our decisions today and the future of our planet.
So what's next for you in North Africa? What else are you hoping to put together and help us learn more about?
Well, this is, I'll share something with you. This is very, very new. We just found out a few days ago. So a few years ago, we described a giant flying reptile from the Sahara. It's the largest flying creature known from the African continent, 20-foot wingspan. It's a pterosaur or pterodactyl. And we now have new bones of this creature. And they tell us that this animal grew to a much, much larger size than we expected and may, in fact, have been one of the largest flying creatures of all time. And just to give you an idea of what we're talking about, I mean, you know, wingspan is one thing. We're talking about something like 30-foot in wingspan. But to give you a better idea of the size of this animal, just picture a giraffe, right? Yeah. So this giant flying animal, when it was walking around on land with the wings folded back, it would stand on all fours. On land, this flying creature would be about as tall as a giraffe. It would actually look the giraffe in the eyes. Isn't that mind-boggling? I mean, that's a flying animal, and it's standing about as tall as a giraffe. So that's one project we're working on at the moment. We're also going to hunt for remains of some very large plant-eating dinosaurs in Morocco's Atlas Mountains. And I also have some plans for fieldwork in South America. And the reason why I picked South America is that, as you probably know, Africa and South America were joined at some point, and they're just starting to break apart. And so we're trying to figure out how life evolved on these moving land masses. So those are all really exciting projects. I wish I could work on all of them at the same time, all the time. But those are some of the things I'm planning to do in the next couple of years.
When we first started the conversation and talking about Spinosaurus, you said that when you were a very young person, you got excited about this. Did you ever envision for yourself, and how could you envision that you would be doing this kind of thing, not that many years later?
You know, I always knew exactly what I wanted to do. And if you're really passionate about something, you know, chances are you will make it happen. I mean, you know, along the way, there will be, you know, many people telling you that it's probably not a good idea, and, you know, or people telling you, oh, don't work in the Sahara. It's a really difficult place to work in, and you're probably not going to find anything interesting. But, you know, just don't listen to these people. I think if you really know what you want to do, you should just stick with it and do it, make it happen. So, of course, for me, this is like a dream come true. It's, you know, being a time traveler and covering all these strange lost worlds. So, but I knew that that's what I was going to do when I was, you know, 5 years old.
Well, I think about with kids especially love dinosaurs and love hearing more about dinosaurs. How much does that energize you in your work when you go and talk to people and get a chance to talk with kids who I'm sure their eyes light up to meet someone like you who's done all these things?
Yeah, I mean, it's magical, because seeing their eyes light up is just, you know, oh, it was all worth it. If you go somewhere and you talk to kids, you know, it's so rewarding. And I think that, yes, kids love dinosaurs, but I think it's because kids have this incredible sense of curiosity. They want to find out more about the world around them. And unfortunately, some adults do not really nurture this sense of curiosity, and it kind of dies at some point. But it's still there. It's dormant, because if you look at dinosaur museums, or if you go to see a Jurassic Park movie in the cinema, you'll see it's not just kids, it's everybody. Right. So I think we have this deep-seated fascination with ancient life. And, you know, so for me, it's very rewarding, you know, sharing this with people, but yeah, especially kids.
Now, very briefly, will people get to see some sort of image of the Spinosaurus tonight?
Absolutely. You'll see Spinosaurus moving around through the water, catching fish. It's a pretty incredible story.
Nizar Ibrahim, National Geographic Emerging Explorer and Paleontologist. We've been talking about the Spinosaurus. He'll be talking about that discovery tonight at 7:30 at the Mesa Arts Center. It's part of the National Geographic Speaker Series. Nizar, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. Thank you very much for listening. If you missed any of our conversations or segments, you can go online later this afternoon to kjzz.org. You can also download the KJZZ free app to your smartphone. I'm Steve Goldstein. This is KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Carl's Quality Bakery, a family-owned bakery and pastry shop. Chocolate-dipped strawberries, artisan truffles, and more for sweethearts valley-wide. Carl's is open Monday through Saturday at Central and Dunlap.